Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, both hours come to you from the Focus 580 archives. In this first hour, a show that we first broadcast on June 12th. So as you listen, do keep in mind that this morning we'll not be taking calls. I expect there are a fair number of people for whom being a park ranger would be a dream occupation. You'd get the opportunity to spend a lot of time out in wild places. It would be quiet and peaceful and probably a lot of fun. And I'm sure that there certainly are moments like that in the life of the park ranger. But there are also moments that maybe don't separate their experience very much from the lives of big city police officers, because it is possible in some of these places to encounter some pretty unsavory characters. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Jordan Fisher Smith. He spent 21 years as a park ranger. He worked for the U.S. Forest Service, for the National Park Service, and also for the California State Park System. He became a park ranger at 22, and he spent time working in four different states, Wyoming, Alaska, and California. For over 13 of those years, he worked in 48 miles of Sierra Nevada river canyons that were condemned to be flooded by the Auburn Dam Project. It was authorized in 1965 and, interestingly enough, still not finished. While he was working as a ranger, he started to write for magazines and continues to do that. He's written for publications including Orion, the LA Times, Men's Journal, Mothering, The Sun, and Backpacker, among others. And last year, he published his first book titled Nature Noir, A Park Ranger's Patrol in the Sierra. That book came out in February, I believe, of 2005, and now just recently has been published in paperback. It's published by Mariner Books, and it is available in the bookstore if you'd like to read the book. And there are some very interesting stories here. He's with us this morning by telephone to talk about the book and talk about some of his experiences. Mr. Smith, hello.
Good morning. How am I coming through from the Sierra here?
Just fine. You're coming through great, like you were just across the street, so that sounds really good.
Good.
Say every once in a while, you know, when I do a lot of interviews like this with people on the telephone, and every once in a while you talk to somebody and it sounds like they're calling from Mars. So it's really it's nice to have a more solid connection.
Well, good.
So tell me, what I know that you started working as a ranger when you were relatively young, and before that had experience in, let's say, wilderness, outdoor kind of occupations. What drew you to this kind of work?
Well, of course, I mean, it was, in fact, that was a wonderful introduction, because I had the same, I guess, misapprehensions about the work that people do in general. I thought, well, now this is a great way to just really have a good life and have some fun. And, you know, I guess I expected that I would do some rescue work. But in general, I just loved being outdoors. And I think that that I wanted to protect the things that I loved the most. You know, I grew up here in the West in the mountains, and I bonded with the Sierra Nevada pretty early in my life, and wanted to protect it. And there was a moment I describe in the book where I was a climber, rock climber and ice climber a little bit, and I came upon these guys up in the alpine zone hacking away at a 400-year-old tree that was, you know, in a very sparse sort of beautiful forest at tree line in Yosemite, and just wanted to stop the damage so badly. I just wished I had a ticket book and a park ranger uniform and could have stopped it. You know, I went and talked to them, and they told me to mind my own business. And I think that was the moment that it really kind of clicked for me that I wanted to do that kind of protective work.
Yeah, there's a really nice line in the book where you talk about that and just how complicated this job can be. This is the line that says the ranger's job involves you protect the land from the people from the land, the people from each other, and the people from themselves.
That's right.
That's a nice line.
You know, you're a protective influence over everything and everybody. But I guess I didn't really know how complicated, as you say, that might get.
Yeah.
And really how much like work it might get when I started out.
I know that you were sidelined. You had to retire because in 2000 you contracted Lyme disease and you were seriously ill. And I guess at least some of the things that I've read said that you're better, but that you're still in some ways dealing with the effects of the disease.
Well, I am. I have, I unfortunately have a chronic infection, And, you know, Lyme disease is very easy to treat. Just to take a step back for a moment, some people don't may not know about Lyme disease. Lyme disease is you contract Lyme disease from getting a tick bite. In particular, there are certain species of ticks that carry a Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. There are several tick-borne diseases in the United States, including Rocky Mountain spotted fever and babesiosis, Bartonella, which some people call cat scratch fever, and a couple of others, Ehrlichiosis, relapsing fever. But certainly the most common is Lyme. And of course, people in outdoor occupations would be particularly prone to getting these kind of infections. And it's fairly easy to treat with antibiotics right after a bite, but unfortunately I wasn't treated, and it got chronic with me, so I'm still kind of fighting it.
Yeah. I guess I raise that, and as we talk more, you'll have the chance to talk about your experiences, obviously, but it raised that point just to, as a way of asking the question, given everything that you've experienced in your career as a ranger, if you had it to do over again, I'm guessing that you would say you would still do it.
You know, I'd do it in a second. I mean, it was the great experience of my life, and of course now I have another great experience of being a writer. But I would do it in a second, knowing everything that I know now. And actually, you know, when the book came out last year in hardcover, there's a website that goes with the book called naturenoir.com. That's nature, common spelling, N-O-I-R.com. And there's a whole page on naturenoir.com about how to become a park ranger. You know, I thought that young people are often interested in going into that work and probably don't know how to start, where to begin to get a job. And so I still recommend it as a thing to do if you really love the outdoors.
Well, again, for people who are listening, our guest, Jordan Fisher-Smith, his book, Nature Noir, is now out in paperback. It's published by Mariner, which is a division of Houghton Mifflin. You can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore or in the library, and questions are welcome. And in fact, we have somebody all ready to go here who'd like to talk with our guest, and we will do that. The caller is in Kankakee on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Jordan Fisher-Smith,
hello there.
Of your book, and between an important prologue and an important epilogue to Nature Noir, a park ranger's patrol of the Sierra, you have produced for us 11 true life tales, which give a tour de force account of a body of experience which only a relatively tiny set of people are privileged to gain firsthand, that of an armed law enforcement park ranger in the California Sierra. Thank you for making this life come alive for us, your readers.
Well, did my publisher pay you to call up and say this?
No, not at all. Well, you have related true life tales. You have at the same time produced for us a work of high art literature, which for your caller even came with a surprise ending, your contraction of Lyme disease, previously spoken of.
Well, you know, when I started writing Nature Noir, I was fairly aware of the field of nature writing in general, and some of your listeners, I think, will recognize names like Barry Lopez and Edward Abbey. Wendell Berry is sometimes included in this group. Terry Tempest Williams, Rick Bass, Robert Michael Pyle, Susan Zwinger, and so many other good writers who've taken on the subject of nature and people, and the people, you know, should be in the picture.
Yes, I think we're reading another Edward Abbey here in some respects. David,
well, I think my work has been compared to Edward Abbey, and I think that I was not unaware when I started Nature Noir that I was following the great work called Desert Solitaire. Mm. That there was a monument that sort of cast a great shadow over my work, and that's, you know, this book Desert Solitaire by Ed Abbey, which he wrote about a couple of seasons he spent as a park ranger down in Arches National Monument in the Southwest. But, you know, a lot had changed since then. And at the time that Ed Abbey was writing and collecting notes for Desert Solitaire, I don't think that there was a general awareness of sort of massive environmental change that we have now. So I wanted to produce a work that showed the beauty of nature, but also the peril that nature was in and the peril that people were in. And I guess what surprised me, even knowing that when I started out, was how much I ended writing about people. And, you know, there's a lot of people stories in this book.
Yes. Your caller would wish to hear more on the questions you deal with at the end of Chapter 10. That chapter entitled As Weak as Water. There, you go into how the American River and its canyon are no longer totally wild or entirely man-made. How no part of the world can be said to be entirely untouched or unaltered by human enterprise, and how for some this fact undercuts the moral claims for saving what is left of wild, unregulated nature and moves mankind toward the notion that perhaps we ought to finish the job of domesticating the earth and yoking all of it for productive purposes. You mentioned that one writer even claims that the Earth's physical and biological self-regulation is now being replaced by electric grids and communications networks that, with the intimate involvement of human beings, will become the Earth's new nervous system.
Yeah, there's. I mean, this this book is one in which I practiced what my friend Utah Phillips calls rant control. You know, I tried not to lecture the reader about anything. But I gave myself one lecture, and that was just at the end of this chapter about running the Whitewater Middle Fork, one of the two rivers threatened with extinction in this book. And in the end, you know, this is funny because this is the second book tour. I'm on the paperback tour now, and there hasn't been a single question about that passage until this call this morning. So that's what's so wonderful about these kind of radio stations is you have such great listeners.
You might think that neither our brains nor our most powerful computers can begin to account for the complex web of interrelationships in the global ecosystem.
Well, you know, there are ideas around, and I think it was sort of the sort of thing that really came into the fore with people like Buckminster Fuller and Teilhard de Chardin about sort of saying, well, you know, it appears that we've now meddled in everything. We really need to step up to the plate and take charge. And we need to operate the Earth like a spaceship and organize the Earth systems for the best possible survival of us and to give these people their due, some other things. The problem with this idea is that the human brain, I don't think, can even begin to hold the complexity that we see in even a small patch of forest here in the Sierra. I think what I've just called it, what you read, the complex web of interrelationships, is almost too grand in a square foot of soil for us to conceive of. You have, in a square foot of soil, you have one fellow who's a soil scientist can describe the particle size of the soil and the parent material and the nature of the weathering that led to that soil's formation. Somebody else might be able to describe the soil bacteria. Somebody else might be able to describe the mycelium of the sort of strands of fungus that run through it and which help release the nutrients for the trees that grow there. And somebody else might describe the fine roots of the trees that are in it. And that doesn't even begin to categorize the insects that live there, the mammals that occasionally burrow through it, the various invertebrates. You know, the idea that we could, at this point, step up to the plate and organize the Earth and run it as if we were running a spaceship is a fantasy. And we're not going to develop that capacity in time to save ourselves. So the argument that I'm making in the end of that chapter is that we need to now guard and keep those areas that are still largely self-regulating and leave them as much free from harm as possible in the face of the great wave of environmental change that's happening everywhere else.
And as you say, also, those areas that have not already been damaged by massive manipulation, save those and to perhaps restore the ones that have been damaged to
Well, that's right. I mean, the American River canyons that I write about in Nature Noir are a perfect example of this because this is an area which paradoxically has been saved by its own condemnation to go underwater now over 40 years ago. The land there was condemned to go excuse me, to go under a huge western dam as tall as the Hoover and four times as wide. And the dam, through a series of circumstances that I describe in the book, was delayed and delayed and delayed and still hasn't been completed after all these years. And meanwhile, this land, which was really badly treated from the gold rush, from the California gold rush forward, it was clear-cut, it was mined heavily, cattle were grazed all over it on steep slopes where soil was lost. It was repeatedly burned over by human-caused fire and in every way abused. Well, under this regime of waiting for it to be flooded, it slowly went wild again. And I describe in the book a miraculous process by which this land was actually healing in the face of its own extinction. And, you know, land can heal, and we can actually assist that process. Land, air, water systems. There is a lot of wonderful work being done now by watershed groups all over the United States and now all over the world, which are groups that are organized along the natural lines of political division at the edges of watershed. And they're restoring water quality, they're restoring creekside vegetation, they're restoring fish populations. So you can actually bring back some of what's been lost as long as the pieces are still there.
I want to thank the caller for his comments. I really appreciate it very much and his thoughtfulness. I have somebody else who's been waiting, so I want to get on to them. Just very quickly, you were talking here a little bit about the proposed Auburn Dam. It was authorized in 1965 and still not built, but I think it
it was partially built.
So I
describe a little bit of that landscape. I don't want to take your caller's time now, but it was partially built and then sort of stopped.
Well, I guess the question I was headed for was, as far as I know, it's never also been officially canceled.
That's exactly right. So this landscape that I decided to write about in Nature Noir was one that lived on like a murderer on death row, mm-hmm. like somebody who's on death row and lives on a series of stays of execution. You know, they're strapped down in the death chamber and the governor calls and then they're taken out and put back in their cell and then they're strapped down again and, you know, the Supreme Court intercedes and they're taken out again. That's the way this land has been living now for over 40 years.
And is there some chance that the dam would ever actually be completed, or do you think this is going to...
Oh, yeah. In fact, at this very time, as the paperback came out in May, there were serious attempts going on in Congress again to get the dam authorized. The congressman in the 4th District of California, which is the whole Northern Sierra, a rural and largely unsettled kind of region, is very, very avid about getting this dam finished. And he's now a very powerful person. He's the 6th or 7th most powerful Republican in the House at this time. So there is a very good chance that this dam could get finished. Hmm.
And is the main thing that driving this the concerns about flooding in the Capitol?
Well, you know, that you obviously done your homework on, and it's impressive to talk to somebody on a radio station that's read the book, you know, and actually looked into the issue. But yes, ostensibly the talk is all about flooding. But of course, this particular congressman, whose name is John Doolittle, has a district that doesn't include any land or cities that are at any risk from that flooding on the American River. So while the stated purpose is to control flooding, and this was a sort of media event designed to pick up the public sentiment after New Orleans, the real story is they want more water so they can develop more. Mm. And the story in Northern California has always been to grab water rights, ship some of the water down canals all the way to Southern California, where it's very dry, and then use the resulting money to build infrastructure for local development and delivery of water to places that didn't have it.
Well, let's talk with someone else. We have someone here who's been patient in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. And unfortunately, I haven't had the opportunity to read your book, but you seem like perhaps the best person to ask this question. What I'm wondering about, and I've heard stories that, you know, seem somewhat apocryphal, but I know there's plenty of crazy people out there in the world, so it could be the case. I've heard that there have been park rangers out west who have actually had their lives threatened by white supremacist survivalist types who have tried to lay claim to some, you know, significant areas of public lands and establish themselves as law, and even gone so far as to issue their own money and generally trying to intimidate people in the area, you know, to do this. And I, you know, could you shed any light on this? Is this an ongoing problem?
Think these,
been
these
white
kind of things have been happening in Nevada in particular. Nevada comes to mind as being the place where we see a lot of that happening. To some extent, sometimes in places like Utah, but all over the, I'd say the Intermountain area, it's a problem. We've now since the late 70s been listening to certain radio talk show hosts who stoke the public's kind of ideas that it would be possible at this time in history for people to live in a kind of radical kind of freedom and independence from each other and lack of interdependence from each other, which of course, you know, in a time when we've been specialized since the Neolithic and increasingly so after the Industrial Revolution. And the idea that you could sort of go out in the wilderness and live completely free of other human beings and their technology and production is, again, it's just a fantasy like the other one we talked about. But people's sort of independence has been stoked here in the West by radio talk show hosts and political operators. And, of course, the goal of this is to get into the public lands, to sell them off for development, for mining, for timber development, for clear cutting, under a smokescreen of concern about the common man. What's really being done is an attempt to loosen the government's control of areas that have been protected since the Roosevelt administration. The first one, the Teddy Roosevelt administration, and release those landscapes into the hands of corporations. So, as a result, you know, some people have gotten fired up and they've done things like blockaded Forest Service roads. There was at least one ranger station blown up to the east of us here, threatened rangers. But, of course, you know, this kind of business of rangers living under threats goes all the way back to the beginning, and I think I've said that in Nature Noir. It's always been tough to separate out a piece of land from the general wave of change, human-caused change around it, and say, no, not here. This is protected. Whenever you do that, you stand in the way of harm, and it's been going on from the very beginning, since the 19th century.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Jordan Fisher-Smith. He spent 21 years as a park ranger in Idaho, Wyoming, Alaska, and along California's Sierra Nevada mountains and coastline, working for the Forest Service, for the National Park Service, and the California State Park System. While he was working as a ranger, he also began writing. He wrote for a number of magazines and has written for Orion, for the LA Times, for Men's Journal, Mothering, The Sun, and Backpacker, among others. And last year he published his first book, Nature Noir, A Park Ranger's Patrol in the Sierra. That's an account of some of his experiences as a ranger. It was first published in February, in hardcover, February 2005, and then in May came out in paperback, and it's a good read. It's published here in paper by Mariner Books. You certainly should be able to find it in the bookstore if you want to read the book. And questions, comments are welcome here, too, if you'd like to talk with our guest. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we'll talk with somebody else here, someone in Effingham on our line 4, toll free line.
Hi. Thanks, Gordon Schmidt, for your works on stopping the Auburn Dam, do you know the Western States 100-mile endurance?
I do indeed. The caller is referring to a very famous trail that runs right down through the canyons threatened by the dam, and it's a 100-mile trail that's on which a very famous foot race is held every year, where you run over the top of the Sierra, and also a similar horse race.
Right.
And so, of course, I'm familiar with it. I worked along the trail for years.
Yeah. I'm one of the participants.
Well, I think you're nuts.
No, not really, because
these people are remarkable people. Can you imagine starting out one day and running over the top of the Sierra for 100 miles and coming in alive and actually living to tell about it the following day?
Very beautiful country, and I hope you keep up your good work, because I did it four times, and I enjoy it very immensely. And I hope
we've always been privileged to have that race go through these canyons because it, you know, it brings attention to the to what's there.
Right.
Know
and,
it, so.
Yeah, I hope you further success in stopping it because it's like it's too beautiful a country to be covered up with water.
Well, that's what I thought, too, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, of course.
Yes, and I thank you again from Western States Runner, and I think everybody that ran the Western States probably hope you the best of luck in keeping it stopped.
Well, it's great to hear from you.
All right,
well,
thank
thanks
you.
For the call. Other people who are listening, if you have questions or comments, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think that the thing that will surprise people reading the book is how much of your experience as one of those park rangers that is armed, and not all of them are. So you went, you carried a gun, you wore a bulletproof vest. You dealt with some pretty dangerous folks, people who were mining illegally. Sometimes they were squatters and they were literally homeless people. Sometimes there were people involved in other kinds of illegal activities. I think people would be surprised about how much your job, at times at least, would end up being like being an urban police officer.
Well, of course, I think that the part of this surprise that we feel about that goes back to our own ideas about nature and people, you know, and I think that that goes back to maybe the natural rights movement and the kind of the idea of the noble savage and some of this 18th century thought where basically philosophers said, well, human beings are ennobled by being in contact with wild nature, and you see this in James Fenimore Cooper's work, you know, the leather stocking kind of character who's this noble person who, from just the contact with wild nature. And, of course, the reality is that you know, some people, I mean, most of the people you meet as a ranger are good people, and most of them have come there to enjoy and glory in the beauty of the things that you love, too. And you have a lot of nice experiences with people. But, of course, some people who get there are just as drunk when they get there as when they left home. And other people have problems with drugs. There are people who have problems with spousal violence. There are people who steal from other people. And while a park or national forest is still safer for the average citizen than probably any town or city I can think of, I mean, it's really statistically safer for you. It isn't for the rangers who work there, because their job is to seek these people out. And unfortunately, as usually was the case with me, you end up being alone when you find them, and you're a long ways from getting any other help. So we encounter every kind of human experience, and one of the things that distinguishes a park ranger is that they are trained to pretty much be the ombudsperson for every possible event. I mean, if a baby needs delivering and the mother isn't going to make it to the hospital, you're going to deliver that baby right where you are, and you're trained to do it. If there's a fire, you better get out your shovel and start digging line. If somebody needs to be told what the name of that wildflower is, that's your job too. And if you come to a remote trailhead and see somebody breaking a window to get the stuff out of the cars, why, your job is to arrest that person on the spot. They may not want to go easy.
How many rangers actually are armed? Because I'm sure
all
of them are.
In the California state system that I worked for at the time that I'm describing in this book, all of them are.
Oh.
The National Park Service, in its 389 parks, going from the North Slope of Alaska to the Virgin Islands and to Hawaii, and everywhere in between, has more of a specialized kind of segmentation of their workforce. There are some rangers whose duties only include the interpretation of, description of, and sort of public information about nature and history. Those people are called interpreters, meaning they interpret the language of nature to the common person from cities, you know. And they lead the nature walks, and they lead the historical walks, and so on, and they give slide programs. But there are, in the National Park Service, last time I checked, about 1,600 1,600 peace officers or law enforcement, federal law enforcement officers, and I was one of those also. I worked for the National Park Service in that capacity. And those people are not just law enforcement officers, again. A great many of them hold advanced degrees. You know, it's very common to find somebody who's an experienced federal law enforcement officer who has a degree in botany or archaeology. There are people who have sometimes, somewhere in their career, run a museum as an administrator of a visitor center museum, sometimes quite large. There are people with advanced medical and rescue qualifications, and they hold all kinds of obscure qualifications in things like running dog sleds in Alaska, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, handling a bunch of dogs that want to eat each other on a sled in the middle of the wilderness is a skill in itself. Some of them are licensed pilots who fly airplanes or helicopters, and so on.
The book describes some of your various experiences during this time when you were working as a ranger. Tell us a story. Tell us a... I don't know if there's a single story that's represented the experience. It's all going to be a little bit different. But tell us a story.
Well, I mean, it's sort of these diametrical opposites. You know, on the one hand, I remember a particular tree that sat at the upper end of Lake Clementine. And the tree, this was a ponderosa pine tree that had probably been dead for 15 or 20 years. And it had been turned into literally an apartment house by acorn woodpeckers. They're a very colonial sort of bird. They like to live in community with each other. They share resources and sometimes even childcare, you know. And as you looked across the water at this thing, you just marvel at the number of doorways. You know, they have all these little holes that they're living in, and the birds flying back and forth and, you know, bringing nuts in and so on. And that was a thing that I always enjoyed looking at with children. Because these are such demonstrative birds. On the other hand, I remember a day that we got a call that there was an old woman who had been, I'd say a middle-aged woman, actually, who had been contracted to watch over a very remote camp that the whitewater rafters were using up on the Middle Fork. And her job was just to hang around the camp, make sure the equipment didn't get stolen. Pretty much in the, you know, long jeep road to get in there or float down a whitewater river. And we got a call that she'd been run out of her camp by armed people. That doesn't happen every day, so I went and, you know, there was nobody to back me up as usual, so I called the resident deputy who lived in a nearby town, and he and I went out there in my four-wheel drive. And we encountered these people coming out. You know, we were on a jeep road in the middle of a pine forest, and there we are, two vehicles facing each other. And there was no license plates to call into our dispatcher, so I got out and asked them to see their registration on the car so I have some kind of way of identifying them. And as the fellow reached for his registration, he pulled a gun on us, got ready to shoot us. I kind of, in that surge of adrenaline, levitated him from behind and smashed him into a pine tree, at which time he kind of lost his ire to shoot right away. It distracted him, and we immediately sort of seized the others and proned them out on the ground. And of course, there was a mobile methamphetamine lab in the back of this vehicle. They had been making drugs down there in the wilderness.
I guess one
the diametrical opposites of ranger life.
Well, I guess one of the advantages of for illegal activities of a place like this is it is remote, and there aren't going to be a lot of people around to see what it is that you're doing, except, of course, maybe somebody like you.
But, I mean, again, these people were probably, you know, they're more of a threat to the rangers than anybody else. And I don't want, on this book tour and in talking about my book Nature Noir, I always want to tell people that the fact that I describe this kind of thing happening to rangers in remote areas doesn't mean that it really happens to other people. Largely, the sort of people that you find out there sort of don't want to be, they don't want to meet anybody else. They're there to kind of hide out. And you know, it's safe for the average person. It's just not very safe for rangers because your job is to go out and find these people. But everybody else in that canyon that day was having a fine time other than me when this fellow tried to shoot me.
Of those kind of people, the people who don't want to be found, how many of those people are armed?
Well, you know, in the West, and I think in Alaska, there is a huge gun culture. And again, it sort of dovetails in and fits with this idea of radical independence, you know, that you should have your weapons and lots of ammunition, and that way if anything bad happens, you can hole up in your cabin and I don't know what you're going to eat, but, you know, you can live through the end of the world, you know. And guns are part of that idea of radical independence. So in the American River Canyons, which was an area that was not perceived by the public to be a park, it was perceived to be a dam site. A lot of people carried guns, and in part because there was gold miners in there. And the gold miners, as a lot, had a way of sort of living like 19th century gold miners. You know, they tended to dress like old-time miners, and they wore weapons. So I dealt with a great many armed people, but of course that goes way back too. I tell in the book about the development of park rangering and sort of where it came from, and our forebears were the horse soldiers sent in to pacify the parks. When the parks were first created, Yosemite and Yellowstone, they weren't given any kind of force of caretakers. And, you know, by 1875, 3 years after the creation of Yellowstone, this million-acre park in Wyoming, the Secretary of War reported that 4,000 elk had been slaughtered by poachers in the previous winter alone. So something had to be done, and by the late 1880s, they moved the army in, and these cavalry soldiers then made it safe to be in the parks and made the parks safe from the people who were visiting them, because by 1880 there were 10,000 people visiting Yellowstone a year with nobody watching over them. So the soldiers, one of the things, for example, at Yosemite, the first thing this fellow did who was one of the commanders was to set up a checkpoint and confiscate every gun coming in the place. And there was a huge hue and cry about it. This is circa the 1890s. You know, oh, you're taking away our right to bear arms. This is wrong, you know. But, of course, it was the only way that he could keep the wildlife alive, because there wasn't going to be a ranger there when these people shot park wildlife. And that kind of interaction between guns and wild places has been going on ever since.
We have another caller here. Let's talk with him in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you for your years of service. The overall picture I'm slowly acquiring through different publications, one through a public employees for environmental responsibility newsletter, is that very slowly especially the national park system is being whittled away at the edges through budget reductions, development at the park edges, and we're slowly losing what we have tried to preserve. Now, is that a mistaken impression? I would like to hear your opinion.
No, not at all. I think we're in a very serious time for the survival of our national parks. And it's true that, Park Service, National Park Service budgets have been disastrous over the last couple of decades. My whole career, in fact, was spent under a regime of either holding your own or losing something. And the current situation is that the National Park Service managers, superintendents, have been asked to keep their fixed costs, meaning salary and garbage removal and things like that, down to 80% of their budget. Well, a lot of times these budgets are so tight that fixed costs actually account for 95, even above 95% of their budget. So the only way they can meet this directive, which comes directly from the Bush administration through Park Service Management, is to, when somebody retires or moves away from their park, to hold that job open. The result of this is that a ranger going on something important or dangerous can't get back up. And there's a great deal of burnout right now. and there's some very, very serious danger to rangers. There were last year, for example, 63 assaults on national park rangers, 9 of them in Yosemite alone, all of which, luckily, were with fists and feet. Often these assaults involve firearms or knives or sometimes vehicles. A number of rangers I know, people have tried to run them over. It happened to me once.
Damn.
Almost shot the guy.
I wish I heard better, but thanks
well,
for the
you know,
reality.
I think all I can say to you as the caller is, you know, that's what voting is for. And if you agree with what this Congress has done, then, you know, maybe you don't need to show up for the midterm election in November. If you disagree with what this Congress is doing to the National Park Service, you have a referendum on that in November, and you ought to pay attention to which candidates have been doing good things for the things that you love.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, our guest, Jordan Fisher-Smith. He spent 21 years as a park ranger working for the Forest Service, for the National Park Service, and also for the California State Park System. And also during that time, he started to write and last year published his first book, Nature Noir, A Park Ranger's Patrol in the Sierra, about his experiences. It's now out in paperback. It is published by Mariner Books, which is a division of Houghton Mifflin. You can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So when did you start getting interested in writing?
Well, you know, I think that the moment that I remember that crystallizing for me was the time in the late 80s when they held the first Senate hearings on global climate change. Those hearings, I think, were initiated by Al Gore and I think maybe Tim Wirth of Colorado. And I listened to James Hansen of NASA, and of course, NASA isn't what you'd call a radical environmental organization. And Hansen said, "Yes, you know, we have an observed rise of 1 degree Celsius worldwide in overall temperature, and we've got an observed rise in carbon dioxide from human burning of fossil fuels. We think these two things are related, and there's no question that the climate is changing." Well, that really got my attention, and my whole concept had been to strap on a gun and a badge and stand, you know, in guardianship of these places that I loved so much. And I thought, well, if the very climate and the world around them was changing to that extent, then what I was doing might be a failure. And so I began thinking about trying to extend my protective influence outside the parks, you know, and doing the kind of work that park rangers do in campfire talks and in slideshows and in lots of other ways, just talking with people, to, you know, convey a little bit of the perspective that we develop from working in these places. I think that you develop a perspective a bit like an endangered species, kind of peering out through the remaining pine forest toward these gray areas where everything is changing and feeling somewhat threatened by the process outside the parks. So that was where the desire came from, I think, was I wanted to write as a park ranger and tell people what I was seeing, you know. That's where it came from. Hmm.
I want to ask you about, if you can update on one of the things that you write about in the book, because I've come across it in one of the reviews of the book that I looked at. And this has to do with a case of a woman who disappeared. Without a trace, her husband had
reported
missing.
Well, now there are a couple of women who disappeared.
Well, I'm not thinking of the
one was eaten by a mountain lion.
I'm not thinking of the one that was eaten by the mountain lion. I'm thinking about the woman who disappeared and actually,
yes.
I think her husband was maybe suspected of foul play in her disappearance.
Her husband, who at the time was a sheriff's sergeant in the county, has now been named as a suspect in this disappearance. And the case for a long time has been looked at as a homicide. And, you know, I think what I set out to do when I wrote this book was to tell some of the stories that I couldn't forget, where people's lives were interwoven with the stories of these canyons that I had worked in for so long. And this was definitely one that none of us could forget. It haunted us to know that she was somewhere out there, maybe stuffed into a mine shaft or buried in a shallow grave up under the Manzanita someplace, and we couldn't find her. And so I wrote an account based on my familiarity with the police reports and the search reports that came after the initial disappearance and the coverage in the press and my own involvement with the case. I was briefly involved with the case of this crime or this disappearance.
And you think because you wrote about it in the book that somehow stimulated interest and warmed up a case that had been called for a long time?
Well, all I can tell you, I mean, you know, all I can say is that about 3 weeks after the book came out and was in the New York Times Book Review and a couple of other major publications, suddenly the police were serving search warrants and digging up people's land, you know. But, you know, it could have been a coincidence. There hadn't been much action on the case for 23 years, and 3 weeks after the book came out, they were digging with backhoes in the yard of the parents of the suspect. Hmm. So, but unfortunately, you know, charges have not been filed. It's very, very hard. They still haven't found this woman's body, and it's very, very hard to prosecute a bodiless homicide, you know, 23, 24 years after it happens.
Yeah. We're coming down. We have a couple of minutes left. We have someone who asked a question off the air, and I think that it's a good one, and that is whether we should be concerned about commercial interests moving into national or state parks.
And, you know, you have some great listeners back there.
Yes, we do.
So thrilled with the kind of questions we've gotten this hour. Yeah, we have a great deal to be concerned about there. Again, this administration is one that celebrates the private over the public, and something is presumed to be good if it relates to private business and corporate business, and it's presumed to be questionable or suspect if it relates to the public good or the public wealth. And national parks are part of our permanent inheritance and public wealth as Americans, and we're living in a time when, you know, that's not a very snazzy thing. Well, the latest thing is that the Park Service announced last December, and this is coming from the administration, that they were going to sell space on their kiosks, the entrance stations for billboards, and on their ranger cars and vehicles for corporate logos. You know, this ranger brought to you by name the corporation. Also on their websites, that they would have links to corporate sponsors on websites. And what they're trying to do, of course, is to wean the national parks, which have never cost much in the first place, off public money and make them supported by corporate advertising. I think it's a very bad idea. I think what you go to for the parks is a kind of quiet and peace and a certain remove from the confused and chaotic world outside. Part of that confusion is the constant sales talk that you have to listen to, the invasion of your space and your sort of awareness by constant advertising. And this is one of the worst ideas I've ever heard of.
For people who have never really had this kind of experience, maybe the closest that they've ever come is to some little forest preserve who don't really, and for whom it would be a big jump to, say, to go into a wilderness area, how would you suggest they go about having a little bit of this kind of experience?
Well, you know, the first thing I would suggest is to car camp. Or even, you know, to avail yourself of some of the opportunities to, you know, rent a little cabin and then just start going on day hikes. But the other thing is that I see nothing wrong with that little forest preserve near your home. In fact, I'm kind of interested in those. I think you don't need to drive to or fly to a grand national park here in the Sierra to experience nature. You need to maybe start figuring out what those birds outside the window are and where they live in the wintertime. You know, we have birds here in the Sierra forests that spend their winters down in Central and South America. That's a remarkable thing to me. And by the same token, we have birds to the west of us in the Central Valley in the winter that spend their summers living among muskoxen on the north slope of Alaska. So you're connected to nature wherever you are, and I encourage people to find out what's close to them. Find that little forest preserve close to them.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you giving some of your time.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Jordan Fisher Smith. He was for 21 years a park ranger in Idaho, Wyoming, Alaska, and also along California's Sierra Nevada mountains and coastline. And he's authored a book that is about his experiences as a ranger. It was first published last February, that is of 2005, in hardcover, and then this year just has come out in paperback at the beginning of May. The title of his book is Nature Noir, A Park Ranger's Patrol in the Sierra, and it is published by Mariner Books. That's a division of Houghton Mifflin. And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. It was first broadcast on June 12th. There are many past interviews from Focus, also the Afternoon Magazine. In fact, all of the local production that we have on WILL is available on our website, and you can listen anytime you like. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU. We will have another program from the archives in the second hour. This goes back to April, and the guest is Simon Winchester, who's authored a number of interesting books, all of them about natural topics. He was here visiting the campus at that time, and we talked about what is now his most recent book. It's A Crack in the Edge of the World, and it's all about the great San Francisco earthquake that happened 100 years ago in April, on April 18th, 1906. The city was destroyed by this enormous quake. There were, of course, the violent shaking that you expect from an earthquake, fires that came afterwards. 490 blocks were wrecked, more than 700 people died, and over 250,000 people were left homeless. So you can hear this conversation about one of the worst natural disasters in American history that we first broadcast in April. You can hear it in the second hour of Focus 580 today, so we hope that you can stick around. Also coming up a little bit later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn will be bringing back an archive that she did, a past interview that she did, focusing on the year 1973. This was the year the Supreme Court decided the Roe decision. It was the year that the last U.S. combat troops pulled out of Vietnam. It was the year of the Senate Watergate hearings and of the OPEC oil embargo. For all of that turmoil, there was also a great deal of creative energy in popular culture and in the arts. A look back at the 70s in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today, as we rebroadcast an interview with Andreas Killen, author of the book 1973 Nervous Breakdown. That's the Afternoon Magazine. Gets underway at noon here on AM 580, live with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other things. The broadcast today, by the way, made possible by a grant from the Great Impasta, restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. We will break for an update on the markets and news, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible.